Hello, everyone, and welcome to the TMA Ask the Expert podcast series. Today's podcast is entitled The Power of Sharing Stories. I'm Roberta Pesce from the Transverse Myelitis Association. We are a nonprofit focused on support, education, and research of rare neuroimmune diseases. You can learn more about us on our website at myelitis.org. We're pleased to be joined by Rebecca Whitney, Pediatric Program Manager on our staff, who will be moderating our podcast today. This podcast is being recorded and will be made available on the TMA website for download via iTunes. During the call, if you have any additional questions, please send them to us via our Facebook page at facebook.com/myelitis, or you can also send a message through the chat option available with GoToWebinar.
Thank you, Roberta. For today's podcast, we are pleased to be joined by Elisa Holt and Courtney Robinson. Elisa Holt is a dedicated wife, mother, caregiver, and community contributor. She's a graduate from Salem State University, where she received her Bachelor of Science degree in psychology with a clinical concentration in pediatrics. Elisa is a childhood cancer survivor who has worked closely with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, Massachusetts chapter, since 1999 in their advocacy and funding efforts. Her focus changed gears when her son Noah was diagnosed with acute fosfomyelitis in October of 2014. Since then, Elisa and her husband Mitch have focused their efforts on how to take back AFM. She is the current Mrs. Massachusetts, United States, 2015, and is using her title and position to bring awareness to the rare neuroimmune disorders community. Elisa, Mitch, and their friend Gayla have volunteered their time and are directing the 2016 Massachusetts Walk, Run, and Roll this fall to benefit the TMA. Courtney Robinson is a mom of two, Kingston and Savannah Robinson. Kingston, her oldest, was diagnosed with transverse myelitis at the age of 3 in July 2014. It was later confirmed that he had the subtype of TM known as acute flaccid myelitis. Kingston could not walk and could not raise his right arm. He went through 8 months of therapy and he's back to walking, running, and using his right arm. Since his onset of TM and AFM, he's completed 3 seasons of soccer, swim lessons, and is about to start his first season of flag football. This disease has changed everyone's life in Courtney's family, especially her son's. Courtney is a passionate advocate and is willing to do anything and everything to raise awareness for these disorders. Thank you both for your willingness to join us today to share your stories and relive some of the experiences that I know from personal experience is often difficult to do. We sincerely appreciate your time and willingness. We'll go ahead and get us started with your stories. My son was diagnosed with TM when he was an infant at 4 months old. As parents of children with transverse myelitis or acute fosfomyelitis myelitis, I know we each have different experiences with the onset of these rare neuroimmune disorders. Some are significantly different than others, and some may share extremely similar stories. Elisa, let's go ahead and start with you. Your son, Noah, was 6 months old when he was diagnosed with AFM. Would you be willing to go back to the beginning and tell us about how you knew something wasn't quite right with Noah? Maybe how his symptoms presented and how they progressed?
Sure. on October 3rd, 2014, it felt like any other day for us. We woke up around 8 o'clock, and at the time Noah was nursing, and I had put him on my bed and he just fell backwards. And I assumed at first that he was full from eating and that he was sleeping, and then I sat him up again and he went backwards again. Immediately you could then, just glancing over his body, tell that his tone in his legs, that it was gone. They kind of butterflied out, and he just wasn't moving. Being 6 months old, you know, previous the day before, he was kicking and standing, and immediately you knew something was wrong. So we proceeded on to call our pediatrician, who told us to go to Beverly Hospital, which is our local hospital here. And we were there about 15 minutes before we were transferred to Boston Children's Hospital.
All right. Courtney, how about you? Kingston was 3, and he had an initial diagnosis of transverse myelitis. Did he present the same way as Noah did? Was it a rapid onset or progression of his symptoms?
I think with Kingston, it was a progression of symptoms. He had strep throat and bronchiolitis that had him down for about a week. And the day that I felt like he was ready to go back to school, that morning he was holding his cup with his right hand, kind of funny. But I thought it was just because he had a ton of stuff in his hands and he couldn't hold it right. And I remember walking through the hall at school and he just kind of fell forward and looked up at me and said, "Mommy, I don't have any injury," meaning he didn't have any energy. And I just thought it was because he was still kind of on the road to recovery and still a little bit run down. And his teacher ended up telling me at the end of the day that he pretty much just sat with his head on the table the entire day at school. So that night, my husband was trying to put Kingston's pajamas on and asked him to raise his arm so he could take his shirt off. And he said, "I can't, Daddy, I can't raise my hand." So Marcus brought him into me and showed me when he lifted up his right arm, it just flopped to the side. So they went to an aftercare place that took x-rays, you know, and did a little bit of poking around on him. And they said he had a tear in his muscle and they put him in a sling and they sent him home. The next day, I decided to take him to his pediatrician because I had no clue how he could get a tear in his muscle, and it just didn't sit right with me with them just saying that's what it was. So while we were at his pediatrician's office, she was running a few tests, and they all came back normal, and her and I were just talking about the next steps that we were going to take, and Kingston was standing against the wall, and he fell. Dr. Gondal went over and helped him up, and he just fell again. And she and I both looked at each other, and I immediately started packing up my stuff. And she said, "I'm calling Children's to let them know you're on the way to the emergency room right now."
Wow. It's all very, very surreal when you hear it and think back.
Yes.
And I can hear similarities in both of your stories with my own son. Once you both went to the respective facilities where you received the acute treatments for your children, how quickly were they diagnosed? Were they able to come up with the TM or even AFM diagnosis rather soon? Did they explain if that was something that they suspected? How did they come to the diagnosis for your children and confirm it?
Do you want me to start? Does Courtney?
Sure, sure. Whomever is comfortable.
When we ended up going to two children's hospitals, the one in downtown Dallas has a really good neurological department. So when we were at the emergency room there, one of the doctors told me they were trying to rule out childhood stroke since everything seemed to be happening on the right side. And, you know, I had no words. I was thinking to myself, there's no way my little three-year-old had a stroke. There's no way any child could have a stroke. So that was our first thing that we were trying to rule out. And then Kingston started showing symptoms with his arm on a Tuesday. And by that Thursday, we were diagnosed with transverse myelitis. After all the MRIs and CAT scans and CT scans and x-rays, we were later diagnosed with acute flaccid myelitis at Kingston's three-month checkup. Dr. Greenberg couldn't fully read the second MRI that they did for Kingston while we were at the hospital. I think there was an issue with one of the printouts or something. I'm not 100% sure. But after he was able to read the second MRI fully, he then changed his diagnosis to AFM. And he's actually pretty certain that he had the D68 enterovirus that was going around at that time, but we weren't tested for it in the hospital. So we're not 100% sure.
Okay. Elisa, how about for Noah?
Noah's case, it was a very sudden onset. The night before, he didn't have any symptoms. Again, this was in October 3rd, 2014. So sweeping the news in September 2014 was about enterovirus. And we were in and out of the pediatrician's office with upper respiratory infections, but because he never was wheezing, we were told there was never to be concern unless he started to wheeze. But at this time of onset, he presented without any infection or cold or anything. So it was really out of the blue for him. Waking up, he went to bed fine. No signs of weakness or anything like that. And when he woke up, that's, you know, when we saw that he didn't have any movement from the waist down. Going into that day, you know, when we were at Beverly Hospital, they didn't waste any time. They sent us right to Children's. When we got there, the Boston Children's Hospital was already on high alert for enterovirus and the polio-like symptoms and AFM. So I think in our case, the physicians were already on alert and kind of had a hunch that this is probably what it was going to be. They immediately scheduled an MRI and a spinal tap. They wanted to test for enterovirus D68. They did say to us that it is possible for Noah to have had it, but by the time the testing had occurred, that it could have been out of the system. So the tests that were done through the spinal tap did come back negative, but they said, you know, it is possible that he could have had it and it could have left by the time we tested it. They did an MRI, which is how they said to us it was either going to be Guillain-Barré syndrome, GBS, or acute flaccid myelitis. And later on, I think it was the next day, they told us it was acute flaccid. Well, they said it was myelitis radiculitis, which eventually kind of tailored down to acute flaccid myelitis. But throughout that day, Noah started, his arms started to get heavy as we were sitting in the emergency room. His head kind of went to the side, and the first few days, then his face started to droop. But IV, IG, and steroids were started that night at Boston Children's. He was allergic to the first round of IVIG, so they had to stop. But the next day they restarted with a different type, which was successful.
Okay, that's very interesting. I know that the enterovirus was definitely making its way around, and acute flaccid myelitis was all over local national news, social media during that time frame. So it's interesting to hear that your hospital, Lisa, was on high alert for that they knew to be watching for that. And I know in Texas they were as well. But it's interesting to hear how difficult it is to actually isolate that as a cause in the AFM. But
I think one of the reasons that it wasn't initial for us, that outbreak didn't come until August, and Kingston was, his onset was the beginning of July. So I don't think that everyone was, you know, on high alert for it to see the symptoms and think, oh my gosh, let's test for this. So he was kind of way before it started. I think that's why it took a while to be diagnosed with the AFM.
Right. And for either of you, did your physicians explain to you why they went with the diagnosis of AFM versus what we know as traditional transverse myelitis? Did they explain it was because of imaging? Anything else? Did they elaborate on that for you at all?
To be 100% honest with you, it was all kind of a blur. Whenever I was in the doctor's office for Kingston's three-month checkup, when they did change it to acute flaccid myelitis. And I think that not being able to read the full second MRI that they did to be able to compare it to the first one, and then having this outbreak of AFM, I think that those two things together might have been the decision maker of changing Kingston's first diagnosis of transverse myelitis to his now diagnosis of acute flaccid myelitis. That's just my opinion, because I really honestly don't remember, as sad as that is to say.
Sure. I don't think you're alone in that. It is all quite a blur when you're experiencing the emergent trauma that's happening with your family at that point in time. How about for you, Elisa? Did your physicians elaborate as far as, you know, what they found, that they went with the acute flaccid myelitis versus transverse myelitis, or was it more of a timing type of issue?
When we initially got there, as I had said, they were looking at either GBS or a type of myelitis. And so for the first few days, it was a myelitis or radiculitis, which was confirmed after the initial MRI, because they said it was due to imaging, the way it was on the MRI, the way the inflammation in the spinal cord. And then throughout our stay, then it was official that they felt it was Dr. Gorman at Boston Children's Hospital in the Department of Neurology had confirmed it was acute flaccid myelitis due to imaging.
Okay. That's very interesting. I know I've seen and heard a lot about the difference between the gray matter and the white matter being affected. And I know that has a lot to do with how they come to the final diagnosis.
Okay. And we also got confirmation from Dr. Benjamin Greenberg in Texas as well.
Okay. All right. I know you mentioned that you received, that Noah received IVIG, Lisa. How soon after he was at the hospital did they begin the acute treatments? And did they discuss any other possible treatments with you?
So when we probably got to Children's around 10 o'clock that morning, and the initial IVIG and steroids were started, I would say, around 9 or 10 o'clock that night, and this was a Friday. And so as far as seeing, you know, he was allergic to the first round of IVIG, as far as seeing any progress, we didn't see it till later on in the week, and it was very minor of just a quick, I think it was like even like a flick of a toe, or we saw more of the droop in the face came back, and he got more control of his head, and his arms were starting to be able to they weren't like wet noodles, but the legs and hips were still very flaccid. And sorry, what was the second part?
Oh, that's okay. I was just wondering about how quickly they started the treatments and if they had discussed any other possibilities. We know that, you know, there are generally steroids, IVIG, often plasma exchange too. And depending upon the facility or the region, it's different as far as what's chosen. So I was curious how they had gone about treating Noah.
Yeah,
they
did IVIG and the steroids, but they did even speak to us about plasmapheresis, but they said they wanted to see how the IVIG and steroids would work first, because in Noah's case, it wasn't recommended because the risk didn't outweigh the benefit in Noah's particular case.
Okay. And how about for Kingston, Courtney?
The night he was diagnosed with transverse myelitis, we started the steroid treatment every 20 hours for 5 days, and there was just no improvement. Nothing had changed. So they ordered a second MRI, and Dr. Greenberg came to talk to us about our next steps of treatment that were available, and we decided on the less invasive treatment of the IVIG. And the next day after he started the IVIG, we could really tell a difference. He just was had a little bit more movement, could stand up more, and could, he still couldn't move his right arm at all, but he could still stand up for a little bit longer of a time than he was able to.
Okay. Very interesting. So you both started seeing some improvement within approximately a week of receiving acute treatments, and doesn't necessarily mean significant improvement, but it was something, right?
Yeah.
Where you were able to do that. When did they start doing physical rehabilitation with the children? Was it while they were still receiving their acute treatments? Did they wait until they were released from the acute floor? When did you notice that they were starting to talk about physical rehabilitation and how it would impact them? Do you want to begin, Elisa?
Sure. For Noah, we finished the IVIG and steroids, and I think that would bring us probably, if we went in on a Friday, my guess would be around, I would say, Tuesday or Wednesday. After the treatment was completed, they had said our next step is rehab. For Noah, they did have a rehab physician come in, assess him, and just kind of work on little exercises in the crib with him, and just they said a lot of massage. So they initially started in our hospital room. That's when he initially began treatment.
And how about for Kingston?
They started therapy for Kingston on Saturday, which was 3 days after he was diagnosed, which didn't really go that great because when we were at the other hospital waiting to go into the emergency room, he kind of lost his balance and fell and bonked his head. So with therapy, he was scared to stand up, and he was going to fall again. But gradually over time, he got better with it, with a lot of bribing from his mom and dad.
Sure, sure. I know a question that we often get asked, and something I had questioned when my son was so small, he was just a little one, was how do you do physical therapy with a baby or even a young child? But it's important. Are they both in physical therapy still today? Have you continued that intensive rehabilitation, and how do you feel that has impacted their recovery?
For Noah, we started with small rehab in the hospital, and when it came to discharging, they felt that it was best for him to go home because he was so little. He turned 7 months while we were there. They didn't feel a rehabilitation hospital would be quite suited for him just because of the amount of therapy they could only do at one time. So we were discharged to home and started with outpatient physical therapy through Mass General Children on the North Shore. And then this was why our paperwork was processing for a program called Early Intervention, which was provided through the Northeast ARC. And we were assigned a case manager / lead physical therapist, Jenna Ely, who eventually took over our case. And they said that all services would be provided in the home, which we felt would be really convenient for Noah in the sense of they would show us how to really do physical therapy, but also how to maneuver him in his own environment. And so we discontinued with the outpatient and transferred into the early intervention program with her. And we started off with one, but she saw that he was improving. So we increased our sessions continuously. Eventually we were at three sessions of in-home physical therapy and then a pool session. And when we saw Dr. Greenberg in this past fall, who said intensive physical therapy was going to be the key to Noah's success, we are currently to this day 7 PT sessions a week, which looks like horseback riding one day, pool one day, in-home PT sessions. So we are rocking and rolling.
good. And I appreciate that you noted that the PT sessions aren't strictly just someone else manipulating the movement for the child. It includes, you know, horseback riding and swim. There's more options available than just strictly being with a physical therapist to move the child. So
absolutely,
I appreciate that.
We just added music therapy and already seeing a difference in that.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. That's great. How did you work with the group of therapists that you were working with to engage them in different types of therapies? How did you advocate for that?
Jenna has been great. And to be honest, when we initially started being a scared mom, you know, I kept saying, I don't see any improvement. I don't see, you know, because you're with your child 24 hours a day. And she kept coming and she said, no, I promise you that he's making progress. And eventually I did see it. Eventually I saw it, but she knew, her intuition was, this kid is making a progress. We need to get more people on board. And then eventually when I started to see it, she was just a wonderful person to collaborate with. You know, she said, these are the services our programs offer. I think you would benefit from pool. I said, sign him up. Then he got a little older and she said, you know, I think horse therapy would really be great. Sign him up. And then it was just me kind of taking the lead from there and thinking, you know what, my son loves music. And I started to do research on spinal cord injuries and Parkinson's. And, you know, yes, they are very different from an AFM or TM patient, But, you know, with a spinal cord injury, people were showing research that this was really being helpful. And I just saw an article on Chronicle about spinal cord patients benefiting from that. And I thought, I think Noah would really benefit from this. So I went to Jenna and I said, what can we do? And so she has really been a great liaison between the Northeast ARC and us, and really helping us advocate for these services, bringing on bringing on a developmental specialist and an occupational therapist who do supplemental therapy with Noah. And I really do contribute that to where he is today, because we are also taught as parents how to stretch him and how to make his play environment, because he is very therapeutic, you know, so he's playing, but he doesn't realize at the same time he's making strides and gains because his play environment does challenge him.
Yes, exactly. I really appreciate what I'm hearing from you about, you know, the thinking outside of the box and encouraging additional options with your therapist, and also from her. It sounds like you have great communication, and then also looking at other possibilities that may have applicability in other disorders. I know it can be frustrating to, you know, look up acute flaccid myelitis or transverse myelitis and not seem to find specific protocol for therapy services that are guaranteed to work, but it's about looking at what's available and what works best with your child. Mm. How about for Kingston, Courtney? How did his therapy go? Are you still doing therapy right now? How have you seen his improvement through physical therapy?
When we left the hospital, we did go to an inpatient rehab facility, to Baylor's, our children's house. And we were there for a week, and they sent us home and said, you know, he's improving so much, there's really not much we can do. So we started to do outpatient therapy. We did occupational therapy and physical therapy 3 days a week for almost 9 months. And I truly believe that of course he got better because he worked so hard, but those therapists, I mean, they need all the praise that anyone can give them, because, you know, they're kids and they get bored with something, or mm-hmm. they don't want to do something. So they were constantly on their toes trying to find a new game for him to play that was really actually working his arm or working his leg. So, you know, all the therapists that we have, we just absolutely loved. And this past week, March 23rd, marked the 1 year anniversary of Kingston's last day of therapy. So we've been therapy free for an entire year.
Wow, that's awesome. And it sounds like he's very, very involved in extracurricular activities. So a lot of times too, I think that can take the place of therapy, because they're getting the movement, they're getting the exercise, they're engaging those muscle groups, and also for the social aspect of it, I think is incredible.
Yeah, so his therapist, I told him he was about to start a soccer season and do swim lessons, and they were like, well, then you're done with us because you're continuing it outside, and he doesn't have to, you know, mess up his schedule anymore. He can just, you know, do normal things like normal children, which I hate to use the word normal, but for lack of better words.
Yes. Thinking of the regular activities that children can do can also be therapeutic for them.
Yeah.
So that's great. So with Kingston, he's probably preschool, elementary school age, right? And we'll be looking at school in the fall. How are you preparing him, or rather, how are you preparing the school for any accommodations or needs that he may need to have met as he's entering the school?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Kingston going to kindergarten. It's a big milestone. And, you know, I like to think, like any other mom, I'm getting him ready by talking to him about a new school and not knowing anyone there, but making friends really quickly. I will definitely let his teacher know about his acute flaccid myelitis, but I don't want it to define him. I really want him to define it. I was just telling my husband the other day that we can't let AFN him be his crutch. We as parents can't hold him back because we're scared he's going to fall or hurt himself mm-hmm. or any other worries that any other mom or dad has with AFM or TM or nothing. Mm-hmm. So I'm really trying to not coddle him.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, I think that's excellent. It is all about what works best for your child and your family.
Yeah,
and I know, and with the early intervention services that Noah is receiving, that will continue through eventually as he goes to school. I know we used early intervention services ourselves, and eventually that can go on into becoming an IEP if necessary. So that's something that you're already putting in place for Noah while he's still very young.
Yes, we hope to send them to preschool next year, so it will give us a year to transition to work with the school with early intervention to help prepare him. Just more in the figuring out what therapy will look like after earlier intervention ends.
Okay. All right. So your stories, they give me encouragement. They give me hope. They give a lot of others hope too, that although what you have gone through, what your boys have gone through, there's still a lot of possibility, a lot of room for repair and recovery. And I think that's great. I really appreciate that, and I hope others do too. How would you describe how they're doing today? They're still obviously improving. What do you hope for the future for them? Do you anticipate that there's going to be more recovery? Is that what you are hoping for? Just kind of give me an idea as far as what you may envision for your children 2-5 years down the road.
For Noah, so as far as his future, when we did meet with Dr. Greenberg, it sounded like therapy would continue for a very long time. It may not look like it we're doing now as far as 7 sessions, but maybe, at some point we might go down to 2 or 3 times a week, or it can look like kind of what in Kingston's story is, he's going to be doing extracurricular activities that could take place as a therapeutic thing. So we're very hopeful because with intensive physical therapy, we were told that Noah would lead a relatively normal life. It will be in time that we will actually see what that looks like, but we are very hopeful in his recovery because of the services we are receiving now and the tools we are getting to equip him for the future. So we as parents have hope that he will walk without assistance, that he will be able to, play sports and just, again, like Courtney said, for lack of a better word, be a normal kid without anyone thinking that he ever had AFM. So that's our hope for the future. And will there be bumps along the way? Could there be setbacks? Absolutely. But I think right now for us, we are just focusing that he has such a great team behind him and that his future looks so much brighter than it did in October of 2014.
I understand. How about for Kingston, Courtney?
I would say he's about 95% recovered. He still needs to build up strength in his arm. He's starting to get a little muscle there, but it's definitely nowhere near his left arm. And he needs to build up strength in his, thighs and his hip muscles. And you can really only tell that when he gets tired. He starts to run a little, crooked. But if you didn't have any idea about what he's been through, then seeing him run, you wouldn't think anything about it. So, like I said, he just started his first season of flag football and he loves it. And he's out there with those kids just running and being a kid. And I just want him to continue to do that and just to enjoy it,
Yes, I completely understand. You know, I never thought when my son was diagnosed with transverse myelitis, what, you know, looking ahead would be like. And I can honestly say that we are much further ahead and in a better situation than what we ever thought when we were first diagnosed. But I think a lot of that was because we didn't have a whole lot of resources available to us at that point in time. It's been several years now for him. So I'm curious for you, either of you, whomever would like to share first, when you were diagnosed, did the hospital give you any kind of resources, anything from the physicians, social workers? Where did you find that you received most of your support and the best information that was helpful for you?
I'll take that. When we were initially diagnosed, we really weren't given we weren't given very many resources. I do remember Tricia, one of Dr. Greenberg's nurses on his staff, told me, do not go on the web and Google transverse myelitis. She told me, only go to myelitis.org, and which for once in my life, I actually listened. And I'm very thankful for that, because I probably would have gone online and seen all of these stories and freaked myself out more than I was freaked out as it was. But, you know, I had the support of my family. My sister took over taking care of my six-month-old daughter the entire time we were in the hospital and the entire time we were in inpatient rehab. I have, after the fact, found support, you know, on Facebook pages with the transverse myelitis and stuff like that. But I really found all the information that I needed at that time on myelitis.org. It was very helpful information. It didn't, I mean, of course I was scared, but it didn't scare me even more, you know, if that was even possible. So I think myelitis.org is an awesome website.
Well, thank you very much. We certainly appreciate that, and work very, very hard to put out the most up-to-date relevant information that is available. How about you, Elisa? Was there anything that the hospital gave you? Where did you find that you had your support?
We didn't really have any support when we left. We felt very isolated because, you know, this is such a rare occurrence, and there was about 120 children that we were told at the time across the U.S. with this. And we understand due to HIPAA, you know, they can't kind of connect you with another family unless another family kind of comes out. So we felt a little isolated for a while, but I think in the long run that Canada gave us time to adjust to our new normal. But for as far as resources, we really just went right to our physicians and said, you know, what's the next step? And for us, it was physical therapy. And that was our focus for the longest time, working with our Northeast ARC team and our physicians at Boston Children's Hospital. And then when we did see Dr. Greenberg in this past fall, that's when we heard more about myelitis.org. And we dived right in. He did say for us, though, for Noah, because he was under the age of one at diagnosis, even publications regarding AFM wouldn't really apply to him just because of the age of onset. It's very different from what we were told for someone under the age of one. But we just, again, so we used myelitis.org as well because there's so many things on the internet, and I really didn't know what to believe, you know, because there's so much out there. I really wanted to only rely on a resource that I knew was 100% reliable, 100% did their research on their own, which was myelitis.org and our physicians. So that's who we really used to really process and gain information for okay. After.
And now that you're both a little further out, and I fully understand and appreciate the fact that when you're right after diagnosis, it's hard to reach out. You're very focused on just making sure that you're doing exactly what is necessary, and for the best of your your child, but now that you're a little bit further out, have you found that there's any support in reaching out to other parent groups? Have you communicated with other parents? Have you found that that has been helpful for you at all? I know we do get calls and emails often, because as you mentioned, Elisa, it is very isolating and it's very lonely to experience something so unusual and to have that rare tag on it. And you know that there are others out there. Have you found any support in recent months from the parent community?
I think that Facebook has been really helpful for me. There's two sites that I just absolutely love. One group is Moms and Dads of Kids with Transverse Myelitis, or another one of Parents of Children with Polio-like Syndrome, Acute Flaccid Myelitis. I just really feel like these groups are so supportive, and the people on there post informative articles, and I really wish that I would have been a part of these groups whenever Kingston was first diagnosed, and, you know, the initial onset and, you know, the changing of our lives. Because, like you said, it's very lonely. I really felt like I was the only person that was going through it, and no one understood how I felt, and no one understood what I was going through. But with these groups, you know, I can guarantee you what you're going through, someone is going through it right now, or they have been through it, and are more than willing to talk to you and help you through it and answer questions, you know. That was my main thing, is I just had a ton of questions, and I didn't know who to ask. I didn't know, you know, because there was no one out there that I knew that had this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And how about for you, Elisa?
I would agree with Courtney. I think the first, Courtney, you told me about the acute flaccid myelitis.
Yes.
And that was great, because for us, it was like an answer to prayer of just saying, you know, like we felt so lonely. And so then it was great to be around other parents and an online community of, hey, we understand, we've been there. It's definitely a place of encouragement, because you have, you know, unfortunately, you do have new families coming in who are just starting out of the gate. But we try to encourage each other. And, you know, for this type of diagnosis, that it takes time. It's a very slow process, but I think these parents in this community have been wonderful of, you know, just supporting each other, whether we're having a bad day or if someone finds something that works. It's just been great to really unite on there as parents.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. I know it was 5 years after my son had been diagnosed that I ever heard about or was able to connect with another family with a child. And that was, for me at that particular time, was very critical. So I'm so glad that you've both been able to find positive support from the parent community. It's very important. It's very important to not feel so isolated. I know we actually have one of our listeners has shared a little bit about her story. Her son was affected with the enterovirus D68 in October 2014, and she's shared that his left leg was the only thing affected, and he now has a brace that he wears that goes up his entire leg and locks up the knee. So thank you for sharing, Lori. I hope that this conversation has been helpful for you. And I think we're coming up on our hour here, so I just would like to kind of see what it is that the two of you, if you could go back, and not that any of us want to go back, but if you could go back to those critical moments, is there anything after learning of the diagnosis of your child, hearing what's happening, what little information is available, what the treatments were, prognosis, anything that sticks out to you that if you were faced with a parent who was being diagnosed today with their child, is there anything that you would want them to know? Just one thing that may help them. Could be anything. Could be support, could be a question that you want them to ask their physicians, anything at all that you would like to share?
If it was one thing I would share, excuse me, it would be that this disorder takes time to heal. It as a parent, all you want is your child to just get better instantly. And when you're in the hospital, we have this thing where when we leave the hospital, they're going to be better and they're going to be the way they came in, just healed. This disorder just takes time. And that's what initially if I were to look at myself back in 2014, I was at least that this is going to take time. And you just have to find that patience and it will come, the healing process for this is timing, but these kids are resilient and they are remarkable. And, for Noah, this is all he knows. He doesn't know any different. He doesn't know that he couldn't walk before. But in time, the progress that we've seen is something I never would have imagined back then.
That's very good. And one that I would go back and tell myself as well, that it is time, and finding that patience within yourself. That's excellent. How about you, Courtney?
Yeah, I agree. Going into the hospital, whenever we were, I just thought, okay, we're going to do these 5 days of steroids and then let's get it going and let's go home. Let's go back to normal. Let's nip this in the bud. And it is definitely a marathon. It's not a race, and it does take time. And that's one thing that I wish I could tell myself back in July of 2014, that just be patient. It's going to happen. We don't know when, but it's going to happen, and just take time. And I would also say, keep hope alive, never lose that faith and never lose that hope that your kid's going to get better. Your kid's going to improve, no matter what kind of improvement or getting better it is.
It's very good as well. Anything else? Anything else that you would like to share that you want others to know about your experience, about acute flaccid myelitis? Anything that comes to mind that we maybe haven't covered and you want to be sure is discussed?
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead, it's okay.
I was just going to say, I can't really think of anything, but for those mommies and daddies that are out there that are newly diagnosed or that are not on those two Facebook pages that I said earlier, I would highly encourage you to jump on there. It's a private group, but you can. I'm on Facebook, Courtney Robinson. Just, send me a message and ask me, and I will add you to those groups because they are lifesavers. Like Alyssa said, if you're having a bad day, you can get on there and 20 other people are having a bad day with you. You guys can talk each other out of it. It's a great resource, I think.
That's very good. And I just want to add to the Facebook groups, there's also a website, and it can be found through myelitis.org. Smart Patients, Transverse Myelitis Community. It's an excellent website for those that are not necessarily on social media or are not comfortable sharing on social media. It is another option where there is information that is shared about studies. There's also personal support amongst the community members. So it's another good one to check out, and I encourage folks to look there as well. It is definitely growing right now, so now would be a great time to sign up for that. And how about you, Lisa? Anything else that you want to be sure is shared?
For our family, I would say advocating for the services Noah has been huge. So for a new parent, my advice would be, one day at a time. It's going to take time, but you want to find a healthcare team that believes in you and your child, and that you have the same vision and goals. you know, you might not gel with your physician, and so there might be another one out there. I do understand this is a rare diagnosis, but we are fortunate that myelitis.com does have a list of physicians in the TM AFM community that you can either connect by phone or maybe, you know, take a trip to see one of the physicians if that's a possibility. But, you know, really listen to your intuition. You know your child best. And I think that's why I've just advocated so hard for Noah's services, because I know how much this would benefit for him. And, you know, for example, if one doctor said, you know, I don't really know much about that, I said, okay, well, I'm going to go to my next doc and I'm going to bring this to them. And, you know, and that's how we got music therapy on board. Because I said this, you know, one doctor was like, I'm not sure. And so I went to my next one and I said, well, this is what I think would be beneficial. So don't lose heart in advocating. And when it does get hard, turn to these parent support groups or call myelitis.com, you know, to turn to your Facebook, your website and say, how do I get connected or who should I talk to? Because you know your child's best, and this is a marathon. We have moments where parents, we're human, that we are tired, that we are stressed, that this is hard, but we can come together as a community and share the knowledge of, you know, well, so-and-so did this. How did they do that? And I think that's what we need to remember, that we are a tribe, you know, that it's going to take a village to get our child back on that road. And so don't give up hope in advocating. Find those physicians that believe in what your goals are and what your hopes are for your child and that gel with your child, because those are the physicians that are going to help advocate for you as well. You want people who are on your same team. Again, Jenna Ely has been phenomenal, and she's been Noah's number one cheerleader throughout this whole thing of being ready to go out and advocate with me. So those are the people you want in your corner. And you know what, you're gonna do it with a team behind you, you know?
Yes, yes, absolutely. Advocacy is a huge part of it. And like you said, sometimes it is a big job, but it's a necessary one. And not being afraid to speak up for your child is going to be key in obtaining the services that you need. So thank you for that. And thank you both. We'll wrap up the conversation now, but thank you both for your time and for sharing your experience, sharing about your children. It's been very helpful. I think it has also been very hopeful too, and reminding us that there is a possibility of recovery. It takes time. It takes advocacy. It takes finding the right information and the right people and connecting with others to make it happen. So thank you both so much.
Thank you
for having us.